it's also really about, like, I feel like, you know, as long as you're following your heart and as long as you are true to yourself and real, being real, what you just you, not everyone, anyone else, but you want to do, then you should do it.
That's Monica Sattler, and this is the All Things Risk Podcast. Welcome and welcome back to another episode of the All Things Risk Podcast. My name is Ben Cattaneo. I'm your host. This is my show. This is the show where we get to go long form using the lenses of risk, resilience, and uncertainty to explore all types of topics. And look, we all make decisions. We all face uncertainty. And the idea here is that we could benefit from learning from one another about how to face that uncertainty in both the world and in our own lives. We are back with another wonderful episode, and somehow it's an episode that I almost managed to lose in the depths of both my hard drive and the cloud, and I got quite a fright when I went to edit. I couldn't find it, but I managed to retrieve the episode to a huge relief because I think this conversation is excellent. My guest is Monica Sattler. Monica is an adventure cyclist. She's also a writer and a vlogger. And I met Monica at the Haute Route, which is, if you followed this show, it's a 7-day stage race through the Alps from Nice to Geneva. And actually, Monica not only did the Alps, but completed the Haute Route Triple Crown, which is 21 days across the Pyrenees, the Alps, and the Dolomites. Monica is currently based in Girona, Spain. And I say currently not just because Girona is in Catalonia, and if you've been following, Catalonia recently declared independence. But as you'll also hear, Monica has lived in 5 countries. And Girona is her destination because it's one of Europe's, and in fact, the world's best cycling destinations. And for what Monica does, it's perfect. Monica inspires people, especially women, to follow their passions. For her, that is cycling. She lives and breathes it. She's completed numerous epic cycling adventures like the Haute Route, also the Tour du Mont Blanc, and many others. But this is a conversation that is about much more than cycling. It's about pursuing your passion. It's about making decisions and taking risks and loads more. I mean, how do you get to make a living doing something like what Monica does? And as you'll hear, it's a non-linear path. There are several starts and stops along the way. But Monica is amazing, and she has loads of great stuff to share, whether or not you are into cycling. And we get into all of that, her background. Monica moved to the United States. She's originally from Germany, but moved to the United States to pursue an earlier passion in volleyball. But she got into cycling, and we hear all about that, particularly adventure cycling, including a very cool story. She explored her first pro race and competing in the women's pro circuit for a little while. And as you'll hear, she gave up a prestigious career to pursue her passion. She did that twice, actually. First at the World Bank, and then second in the world of management consulting. And there are a number of great lessons in all of that. And we hear about an awesome adventure that Monica has planned for next year. So without any further ado, ladies and gentlemen, I give you Monica Sattler. Enjoy. Risk Podcast. It's a pleasure to have you on the show.
Thank you. Thank you, Ben.
You're calling in from Girona, and as we've just heard, it's part of Spain that very recently, about an hour ago, has declared independence. So,
it's crazy.
Is there any is anything happening on the ground, or are people just sort of scratching their heads, or is it business as usual, or
Yeah. In fact, actually, I heard it from an American. He texted me saying, "Oh, Monica, I hope you're okay. You know, what's going on?" And then I looked outside, and actually, I do live quite in the middle of the city. So, and since there's a festival going on anyway, I thought it might be the festival. But now, listening more closely, it was actually a lot of kind of cheering up, and so people on the street and happy. So, but yep.
Very that's it'll be interesting to see how that unfolds.
Yes.
We'll get into why you're in Girona in the first place, but it is an interesting development, and we'll see how the world goes. Risk and uncertainty is part of it. So, but as long as they don't outlaw bicycles, then nothing. there's nothing to worry about.
Yeah.
Monica, I wanted to maybe start off with a little bit of who you are and your background. So basically, you're currently spending your time, your life, adventure cycling, which is very cool. But I wanted to understand how you, I guess, got here. So, but maybe let's just if I always ask the same question to start things off, and that is, when you get asked the question, what do you do? What is your answer? I'm very curious about this one.
That's actually still a very difficult one for me, but I would consider myself, I'm basically a full-time adventure cyclist. On the one hand, I do a lot of cycling, exploring the world, and a lot of traveling, but then also I'm telling the stories of what I'm actually doing. My mission is to inspire others, especially women, to go outside, explore the world, and challenge themselves. And I feel like with cycling, it's the stories I can tell, people feel like more related, even though they're maybe not cyclists. Everyone has ridden a bike before, so cycling is a little bit like a life in a nutshell. There are a lot of when I go through adventures, there's a lot of lessons learned in a very short amount of time. And those adventures, I'm telling those life lessons I tell.
That's awesome. We'll get into that in a little bit more detail, but I wanted to explore your background and how did, if you could trace for me what it was like growing up, and did you want to do this? How did that all come about?
That's a loaded.
Well, let me maybe just start off with. Were you a cyclist when you were young? Did you compete? And
No. So I'm originally from Germany. I'm just going quickly through basically my life. After high school, Abitur in German, I had no idea what I wanted to do. And I was a volleyball player during that time. And I was in four different clubs, loved volleyball, got myself even grounded for playing volleyball because my mom thought I'm sick. I thought I wasn't sick. And I was playing volleyball anyway. And she said, "Okay, Monica, you're grounded now." So really, my heart was always for sports. And at that time, during volleyball. And after high school, I wanted to maybe join the Air Force. I wanted to be study medicine, mathematics. But every week it was changing. The only thing that wasn't changing was my passion for volleyball. And I was like, how would it be possible to actually make volleyball to my main thing? And I realized in Germany, sports is not really, unless you're playing in the highest league, no support. So I tried to figure out where in the world could I be where actually volleyball would be supported. And I realized it would be the United States. I told my dad, "Dad, I want to go to the United States and play volleyball there too, at the university." And he's like, "Well, so how do you plan to get there?" I was like, "There's the schools are a little bit more expensive than in Germany. In Germany, it was for free. Yes. In the States, anything $30,000 and up. And my dad said, I'm not paying it. So you have to figure out how to get there." And I got a full scholarship, actually, to play volleyball in the States.
Oh, that's awesome.
It was actually in a historical black university, which is a topic by itself again.
Okay. Which place was it? Where was that?
It was in South Carolina in the South. It was, here I am coming from Germany with my halfway British accent I learned from school, with the school English, to the deep, deep south in the States, you know, historical black university. They're speaking Ebonics, so they're having a different kind of slang and stuff like that. So I didn't understand anything. So it was definitely a culture shock. So, but after a year, I transferred to a school in Rhode Island. I studied global studies, finished there, and was always into adventure. I was always into adventure. I studied the global studies just because I wanted to be surrounded by, I mean, one of the things was I thought I wanted to become a CIA agent. I was really, and I went, I wanted to actually, work for the BND, for the German equivalent. And that's why I enrolled to a university in Washington, D.C. For security, international security studies. So I was studying nuclear weapons in Iran and North Korea. But then while I was sitting there and studying politics, I realized that maybe this is not actually what I wanted to do, because I was wanted to just be out in the woods, being out there exploring the world. And I realized as a, maybe as an agent, that would
you
be not
it.
Well, I think I just watched too many James Bond movies.
I laugh a bit because I have had a similar desire, because I studied international relations as well. In Geneva, in Switzerland, and I got to the point, I think similar to you, I wanted to be sort of an international man of mystery kind of a thing, but you know, no idea how to make that happen. I also got to the point where it was a very, you know, while the stuff is interesting to study, it gets very theoretical. It's hard to turn that into practice. So that's very interesting. Where did the adventuring come from? Did you, in your childhood, did you travel a lot, or were you influenced by certain movies or films, or where did it come from, do you think?
Well, I grew up actually in a remote farm in Germany, as remote as it can get in Germany. I mean, no comparison to Australia or to United States, but my parents always let us, you know, go and play outside. So we were always never bound to friends. We were just going out and doing our own thing, and came back very dirty in the evenings. So it was always kind of this, we always wanted to discover. And then when I was 16, actually, I had a 6-week stint in a high school in England, actually. And that was first experience abroad. And I loved it. I absolutely loved it. I came back after those 6 weeks and I was like, there's no way I'm staying in Germany. I was so convinced. So, I think those combinations really got me like the taste of what is still out there in the world.
Yeah, that's awesome. It's funny how little tastes of things get you wanting more, and the sort of comfort level around it goes up and up. That's really interesting. One of the weird things I find about the United States is it's nice, but it's unusual for the rest of the world. Is you can get a full education through a scholarship playing sports, which is highly unusual, but interesting and very cool, actually.
Then while I was basically in Washington, D.C., finishing still an international studies degree, you know, I finished it, realized though, it was a pretty heavy topic, you know, the nuclear weapons in Iran and North Korea. During that time, actually, I got a taste for adventure racing. Mm. Have you heard about adventure racing before?
A little bit, but tell us more.
It's a combination of like mountain biking, trail running, kayaking. Those are the three main sports,
all combined with
orienteering. So you're getting a map, a topographical map, checkpoints, and you have to hit them up, or you have to get them. And that happened like in the middle of West Virginia or in Virginia. You know, we were a four-person team, and 24 hours to 48 hours, we were, you know, going through the wild. There were one time at 2 a.m. we were wading through the Everglades, through the Florida swamps, and crocodiles. Always forgetting
alligators. Yes.
In the distance. So all those, you know, crazy things, you know, what you you know, what you consider also like a true adventure. I've done that for 2 years and I loved it. Absolutely loved it.
Is that something you can do as a hobby, or is it, is there prize money? Is there, what does that world look like?
A dirty handshake is the prize money for okay. sure. It's more about really the experience. It's going out there, and if you want to be out in the woods, you know, like a, you know, as a little child, you know, just running around, just as an adult, and with some sort of more maybe as a goal, you know, finding checkpoints, adventure racing is for you. It's very challenging. It's very physically and mentally challenging, because you're definitely getting lost when, you know, I haven't slept maybe for 36 hours and you have to find at 3 a.m. or so a checkpoint and you just can't find it. That was very, that was the adventure I was looking for, actually.
Wow.
So
you're in teams. Is that how it works?
Yeah. Anything from one person to a four-person team, but mm-hmm. basically the elite category of how they call it would be a four-person co-ed team. Mm-hmm. And usually it's three guys and one female.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. Cool. And so it's a combination of cycling and swimming and trekking and all sorts of things.
Mostly mountain biking, long distance mountain biking through the forest, trail running, which could be also bushwhacking. Mm-hmm. So really going through the fastest is through the woods, really, mm-hmm. like no trails, just taking bushes apart and going through it.
Cool.
And then kayaking. That was one time we did 12 hours kayaking in still water and on riverbeds. Yeah.
Wow.
So it was cool.
What was it about that kept you or that enthused you so much? And is there something you can put your finger on that?
Two things. The first thing is really the team. Teamwork in there, because you're a four-person team, you stick together for 48 hours. Mm-hmm. You know, you haven't slept a minute. I don't know if you know, after 48 hours you're pretty damn tired.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
So but then you still, you know, when you still stick together, help each other, you know, the team is as strong as the weakest link, you know, and then really like the bonding, and really you, what kind of stories you're telling each other, you know, trying to keep yourself awake after like the second night and things like this. This really keeps the team together. I loved it. Mm. And the other thing is being almost like the adventure part, so not knowing what's out there, you know, exposing yourself to the nature, to, you know, rain, snow, whatever, heat, extreme heat, and the kind of the, like, where is that checkpoint, you know, finding something. It really brings a certain, the senses, like, heightens completely your senses of what's out there. And it brings you really to the bare minimum, really what I feel like what life is all about, you know, having people around you and trying to survive, basically. You know, sometimes there is no, like in an Ironman or in some sort of other race, where every 5 kilometers is someone handing you water. Mm. No, you have to find your water. Sometimes we had to get into the river and putting, I forgot how the pills are called, you know, to clear out the water.
Yes.
So,
the iodine tablets or
exactly.
Wow. I know a lot of people who actually know a lot of people who would enjoy that a lot. I also know a lot of people who would say that's not my idea of fun.
I can see both sides.
It's fascinating how these kinds of things are really fascinating, because I think there are activities that you do that one does, and then they seem hard when you're doing it, and then you look upon them later and you're like, wow, that was awesome. It sounds like one of those things, but one of the things that comes that I when I'm talking to people like you, it's what happens next, the next challenge, the next thing. So you got into doing this. So I'm trying to build a picture. You're studying.
Yeah.
And then you probably finished at some point and you're thinking, well, what is it that I should do? And then you do these adventures. And so where did you take it? Where does this go for you?
Yeah. So while I was studying, I mean, you maybe can imagine after a 48-hour race, you know, over the weekend, I might not be like in best form on that day, right?
Yes.
So I'm fully scratched, you know, I mean, from going through the bushes. I really, you know, and slightly tired.
Were you working or studying at this time?
At that point, I was studying, but I was actually I got a job with the International Monetary Fund right after, and then I realized, so maybe you know, and I must say I didn't enjoy the kayaking part too much. So I was, yeah. So I was, you know, when someone actually put a road bike in front of me, said, "Monica, try this road bike out, this whole thing." And I was thinking, like, I looked at the road bike and I was like, does that mean actually I'm just going on a normal pavement in one direction and there's nothing really exciting? This will be so boring. And he like, "Monica, just try it out." And then at that point I was working already for the IMF and got into then road bikes. And of course that person who told me that also put me together with a group ride. And here I was thinking like, you know, I'm completely fit, you know, doing those 24 and 48 hour races, I will be like smashing it, right? Well, I got dropped after 5K.
Right.
And that got the competition out of me and thinking like, well, I, there's no way I'm, you know, I get dropped again. So, and this got me really hooked into group rides, into road race, or road riding, road cycling. And I dropped an adventure cycling already because I really loved the cycling part for adventure racing anyway. I was always into the and cycling. The other two were just, you know, they were there because they were there. So that gave me the opportunity just to go road cycling. Yeah, and then I was always part of, like, I loved the group part again. And I was, you know, becoming part of a club. And that point, I also switched my job from the IMF, worked for the World Bank. And within 1 year, I became, from like a beginner, I raced an elite, raced my first UCI race after, I think, 1.5 years. I did not even know that was a UCI race.
I'm right.
Growing up, I was like, oh, why is this all this media attention and why is there so many, you know, cameras? So that was my first UCI race. That was the Philly Classics. Yeah, in Philadelphia.
Okay. I've heard of those. Wow. That's high level.
Yeah, that's, I think one of the higher ones you can go in the United States. And yeah, and I was working for, in the World Bank at that time. And the thing is, I love the weekends. I love the racing. I love being part of, like, out there and exploring and, you know, racing and this kind of endorphin adrenaline kick you get out of there, right? And then I was sitting there from on Monday through Friday from 9 to 5, you know, and sitting and just kind of always put like a bump.
Looking at a spreadsheet after all of that doesn't seem like the most exciting thing in the world, does it?
Yeah. And I just realized for me personally, I didn't want to, I had to change something. Let's put it this way. I was not depressed, but I was so always in such a, you know, it really had such a low during those 5 days where I had to sit somewhere. I was, had way too much energy, to sit for 8 hours. And I was like, you know, Monica, and that was, how many years ago now? 5 years ago. So, after, a year at the World Bank, I was like, you know what? I will give this whole professional racing a go. I quit my job at the World Bank and went to Europe to race then, you know, professional racing in Europe. At the same time, also, while I was going to Europe for that 1 month racing with a guest team in Germany, I also enrolled into a university to study sports because I was like, you know what? I want to do something. I want to study something where I'm really, where my heart lies, and that would be sports. So, well, I applied to the University of Tucson. I think it was Tucson. In Tucson, so Arizona. Beautiful weather because I don't like the cold, you know, riding the entire time. I love Mount Lemmon and, you know, knew already that area. So I was like, this is perfect. And I got enrolled. I got a research assistantship to the University of Tucson with one of the professors who said, yeah, Monica, perfect. We would be, you know, I would love to have you in the team and everything is good. Well, a few weeks later, he called me again and said, Monica, you know, I still would love to have you, but there's only one little change. I will be moving actually to my home home university where I, for my home state, where I will be, you know, where I come from. And I was like, oh, yeah, no worries. Where is that? Minnesota. So, okay. So from one of the warmest states, I went to the one of the coldest states, right? So while, you know, I accepted that I'm going to Minnesota, I went here, I went to Europe, right, for a summer, thinking of, you know, professional racing and seeing what it's all about. And I realized this is not me. All the things what I loved about cycling actually were not there anymore.
Okay.
So,
what was it like? What could you talk a little bit about that? Because I don't. I can only imagine, and it doesn't. For me, when things get too competitive, it starts to take a little bit of the joy out of it.
I must also say, of course, I was there basically just struggling to be in the field. That is definitely one of the bigger burden. But the other thing was also it was a team, but you couldn't really do teamwork if you're not a strong team. So you're basically like a one person show in a, you know, field of 120 girls, you know, who all want to be in the front. And I'm not quite very, let's say, aggressive enough, you know, to put myself like, here I am, you know, I will be in the front and I don't care if you want to get on the same spot as I am. So I found myself very quickly always at the end. So things of, you know, teamwork, of enjoying just the cycling was not there anymore. It was more about fight all of a sudden. And that is not the sport I started to enjoy. So and of course it was, I mean, super high level. The girls are very, you know, everyone is very strong.
What is the lifestyle like as well? Is it imagine it's probably not glamorous. I mean, everything I know about it is not it, yeah. but maybe it'd be useful if you could describe that a little bit.
If you think, you're going to all those nice places, you know, and seeing so many things, nothing of that, because it's basically going from one place to the other and going into the hotel, putting your feet up and waiting until the race is starting or getting ready for the race. Then after the race, of course, there's recovery. So which means you most likely go immediately back to the hotel and recover again, eating healthy food. So although I might have seen or might have, you know, traveled quite a bit in that period, you don't see that much. It's, you know, unless besides your teammates, you also, you don't make a lot of friends around, except that the cycling scene.
Right. Is it, and I take it, it's probably not that well paid.
Yeah, no, I came there as a guest rider. So actually it was the opposite. I was happy that I was even taken rather than.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. So even like, I've talked to other girls and they had to pay to be in those teams, not vice versa.
Yeah, I've already heard about your stories of in the men's professional ranks, and you had some background, you had some education, and you had other options. But people that decide not to or to decide to go all in, and then they're struggling. It's not super well paid, and I'm curious about the discrepancy between the men's and the women's circuit as well, because I imagine that's probably a big gap there.
I'm sure. I can't, unfortunately, I don't know too much about it. But from that little bit I've heard is, if you're just if you're not one of the top racers, you probably have to have a side job. You're struggling.
Okay. So you decided at some point professional cycling, not for you. So this is before moving to Minnesota?
That was before, that was the summer, basically.
Right.
Yeah. I'm glad I did it, though, because now I'd have I feel like, you know, when you are trying to achieve something and then you stop short, and then you always have this dream of thinking maybe of achieving it. I feel like I've been at least if it's a short stint, I've been there and I have no desire whatsoever of this, you know, this. Like, I wish I had done it. So, you know, for me, there's a check and I move on. I was very close of selling my bike and never wanted to do anything with cycling anymore afterwards. But I've been there, done that. So, I went to Minnesota, studied sports. And in fact, actually, during that time, I was thinking, you know, all the things which I did not enjoy about there's a certain things what I love about cycling is, as I mentioned, like the discovery, the teamwork, surrounded by people, getting to know new cultures, the kind of facing a challenge, overcoming all the problems which come with it. And in Minnesota, in the Midwest, there's this whole thing. It just started there, gravel racing, called. Right? And someone told me, Monica, you should maybe try this out. So, and then that was my thing, gravel racing. So, yeah, all on the road, you're getting a small little sheet where it tells you which direction to go. You're not allowed to use GPS. There's no, there's maybe one water stop on a 160 kilometer road, you know, when you're lucky, you know. But otherwise, it's all about, you know, finding your path again. And all the people around you are more like trying to help you and or you help them rather than fighting against each other. And also the low profile, you know, you're finishing and there's no like big ceremony. It's more like, you know, you're having then a bonfire, everyone's sitting one around, you know, and just talking about how the last 30 hours went. And that was way more my style again, this kind of, yeah, being out there, adventure, feeling vulnerable to the nature and what else, yeah, is out there. And yeah, I fell in love and that's what I did. I did gravel racing. There were two definitely worth mentioning. One was my biggest one was Trans-Iowa, it's called. It was a 500 kilometer race. Yeah, it took me 30 hours to do it. And it's a lot of things to overcome. I had huge knee problems. Mm-hmm. Yeah, then food, dehydration, you know, and after 30 hours, you may be a little bit tired.
Right. Know, right. And I take it there are no or there are minimal feed stops and things like this? How self-sufficient do you need to be?
Well, there are two checkpoints. Mm-hmm. Which have no water. You have to get your water all by yourself. And I'm not sure if you've ever been to the Midwest, but in Iowa, sometimes you have to be very, very creative of getting your food and your water. That means sometimes of knocking on doors.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. So, but that was exactly what I was looking for. Not the easy way in. So I want to be out there to face challenges and overcoming them. And then really seeing like how, you know, how much minimum or how much do you really need to survive something? Mm. Yeah.
Were there moments that were tough that you recall? Like, have you ever sort of almost got to the point where you run out of food or water? Or mechanical somewhere in the middle of nowhere?
Oh, you know, okay, this would be a podcast for the next 24 uh-huh. hours. But I would like to tell you one story. So I've done, at that point, you know, I was quite fit, you know, just coming from Europe. And I've done one of the gravel races, 160K, okay. But then people told me about this whole Trans-Iowa. And, you know, not everyone can do the Trans-Iowa. You had to sign up to a certain period of time and then just show up. It was for free. But you have to sign up to that period, otherwise they don't take you. So, okay, I was able to register. I got to the start line and, you know, I've never done, it was a 500 kilometer race, 500 kilometer. Mm-hmm. Only 50 people, I think, started or 70 maybe. So, and over 500 kilometers, you can imagine, you know.
Oh, it gets all strung out and yeah.
Exactly.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
I started and it started at, I think, 4 a.m. in the morning. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you're riding through and really on gravel, everything is so much slower and everything is so much harder. Mm-hmm. And it's not just super hard packed gravel. It can be like so deep that you have to walk mm-hmm. or it can be so muddy that you, when you walk, you have to have problems then clipping in. So, we started riding, 18 hours later or so, I was always told, Monica, when you're going into the night, find people to ride with because you do not want to ride by yourself. Mm. That is when you're falling asleep. That is when you want to get up. And actually, there was a 50%, 50% of the people already quit
right.
After 12 hours. Mm. So I got actually into the night. We rolled into the night with three other guys. You know, it became tougher and tougher. And one of the guys started to fall asleep on a bike. So he really like, we had back and forth and started to fall asleep on the bike. And the other guy broke his one of the spokes, and both of them, yes, exactly, at 2 a.m. when we tried to find a checkpoint. It was cold, you know, we were thirsty, we didn't have any bottles for water anymore. Both of those guys said, you know what, we have to give up. So it was then only two of us. So they called actually a race organizer to, and then their wives to get picked up in the middle of Iowa at 2 a.m. So it was only me and the other guy. And we were actually, you know, we were going for third place overall, you know. So it was, we couldn't take too many stops or something. We wanted to keep going. So we, because you had no idea how many minutes, hours people are behind you or in front of you. So we kept going. But I had actually problems with my knee. And for the entire, from the start already. And I always managed it to do it with ibuprofen. But I don't want to tell you how many ibuprofens I took. And it was so many that this other guy told me, because I ran out of my ibuprofens, and I asked him if he could give me some. And he said, no, Monica, I will not give you any ibuprofen anymore. This is really a dangerous level. Yeah. Then the pain started to sink in. My knees started swelling, and I couldn't actually do the pedal stroke anymore of my left knee. And it was, it was at 2 or 3 a.m., you know, I was tired. I was in deep, deep pain. And, you know, I couldn't keep up with him anymore. And at first he waited always for me that I could start riding with him. But at some point he said, Monica, you know what? I think I have to let you go because I'm worried that, you know, people behind us catch up. I need to let you go. And I realized then he basically left and I would start riding by myself. But at that point, I never rode by myself the entire route. So I did not even know where we are. I did not know directions I was supposed to follow. So, and I realized, you know, it was pitch black dark. There were no street lamps or anything. We were in the middle of nowhere in gravel roads, right? The only lights you saw maybe in the distance, some farms, you know, and some weird noises, but otherwise nothing. And I was like, you know, if I get dropped now by him, and he didn't try to attack me, but, you know, he just rode his own pace. If I let myself get dropped, I will not finish. And it was maybe 50 kilometers out of 500 kilometers, 50 kilometers. And I was like, I have to get myself together. And no matter how deep this pain is, I have to stay with him. And I was really, I tried to catch up, and he heard me, like, really, I was in, you know, I was in super deep pain. I was like crying and stuff, I guess. And he couldn't, actually, he did not want to hear me because I was really, I sounded like a, you know, a dog or a cat, you know, so like whimpering. And at some point he realized there was no way, no matter how strong this pain is, that I will leave him alone. And then, we kept riding together, and then the sun started rising, you know, and then the warmth came up and then we found some water and everything all of a sudden got better. But those 2 hours where I, you know, going through this, you know, this pain and trying to make sense of what's going on, you know, that was, I think, one of the hardest parts during this entire race, gravel racing career, as I say.
That's a wonderful story. I love that. I just love how, as long as you can keep moving, then you know, things change, right? And that's the, so many wonderful analogies. That's why I love that. It's a beautiful story. Thanks for that's great. Very cool. And so again, you're doing these, you know, adventure races, adventure cycling, gravel cycling. So where did it, you know, where did it sort of go next for you? And I'm very curious how you got into doing what you do now.
At that point, I was in Minnesota, you know. Actually, I wanted to be in Tucson. I was in Minneapolis at the U, and I went through one winter. And I'm not sure if you know what a winter in Minnesota is like.
I'm from Canada, so
you're from Canada,
yes. I know, yes.
Oh, awesome. Actually, then I just want to mention, you know, I did one of the gravel challenges, which I went through Manitoba, actually,
the entire
state of Manitoba, 500
Wow.
kilometers as well.
Wow.
So, yeah, that was also one of the challenges I've done gravel racing.
Awesome. Very
But
cool.
yeah, I was in Minnesota, you know, and when it was in April, still so high of a snow that we couldn't park our cars actually in
Yes.
front of our street. I went to my professor, and it was a 2-year program, master program in kinesiology or sports. You know, I went to my professor and said, Eric, as much as I love this program, but there's no way I'm doing another year, another winter in Minnesota. So either I quit this program right now, or you have to send me somewhere else, somewhere warm. And he actually sent me to Australia.
Oh, cool.
So, yeah, he connected me with a former colleague of his in Brisbane, Australia, and said, okay, Monica, now finish your practical study, basically, in Australia. Yeah, and in November, when it already started snowing and, you know, getting cold in Minnesota, I moved to Brisbane.
Awesome.
Yeah, so I finished my degree there. I loved Brisbane, you know, exactly the weather I love. And try to, you know, figure already out at that point, okay, Monica, now you didn't have this my third degree now, right? It was third degree in master's program. This is, I shouldn't be doing that just for kicks and giggles. I should actually make something out of it. What do I want to become, you know, because where I can bring my passion into really into my job. And I thought coaching would be a great thing. Yeah, but I just tried to do the coaching in Brisbane, and I realized this is actually not really what I wanted to do. There are a few factors. One of them, for example, I don't train with heart rate. I don't train with power meter.
Oh, right. Okay.
So,
yes.
So because I want to actually, for me, what I would like to coach is to show, you know, train with basically with your heart, with, you know, with your legs.
With how your body's feeling.
Yeah. But find someone like a coaching agency, which says, hey, Monica, I love your, your mindset.
Yes.
Let's coach that way, right?
Yes.
So it was kind of because I didn't want to just go in a job. I want to, if then I did, I believe in it. And it, I just couldn't align with,
right.
What I was standing for.
Yeah, cycling has gotten very data driven, and in fact, I think that's one of the reasons why it's popular. I was reading something today as popular amongst the Silicon Valley crowd. It's the new golf because one of the reasons is because it's data. It's, you know, increasingly data driven. So yeah, I guess you want coaches who tell you, you know, do whatever, how 20 minutes at FTP or, you know, all of this stuff. And you can kind of follow the program and, you know, watch your watts go up or whatever. But yeah, you don't strike me as somebody who, is that rides from the heart, not from the whatever the data display is telling you.
So, here I am, basically, did my third degree, you know, gave up inspiring career at the World Bank, you know, to study sports, becoming a coach. And I was basically almost like kind of my little bubble of all of a sudden a needle got in as, you know, it just was destroyed of realizing maybe I shouldn't have done this. And this was actually a pretty hard moment realizing maybe, you know, I should have, I should just get this 9-to-5 job, getting a career and, you know, do what everyone else is doing, not trying to really align my passion for cycling with my job. There's saying that when you trying to make your passion your job, then you're not enjoying it, right? So I was thinking maybe that there's some truth to it. And I was like, at that point, I felt like defeated. And I thought, okay, Monica, no matter what, I have to get a job now. You can't just, you know, do all kind of jump from study program to study program. I have to get a real job. And yeah, I applied anywhere in the world.
Right.
Sorry, you want to say?
No, I was going to say, did you feel either at that point or at some point along the way, a little bit of, I don't know, maybe pressure, or when you, for example, left your job at the World Bank, your people saying, what, are you crazy? This is a great job. What are you doing?
Yep.
Did you get some of that?
Yes, especially right. For my dad.
Okay.
I have a great relationship with my dad, but he is more like, he's very German, you know, he's very much into this, you know, you have to get the secure, stable job, you know, where, you know, and he wants have his daughters also to be happy. And that is how he defined happiness. But, you know, he also, supported my decision of quitting the job at the World Bank and going for the sports program. But here I am, you know, after 2 years doing that sports program, realizing that maybe this, I failed in that, what I wanted to do. And my dad, advised me of maybe now finding like a, you know, like a job with a proper career. So, I applied anywhere in the world, and I got an interview actually with IBM in Switzerland, in Zurich, for a management consultant job. So here I am, just I studied sports and becoming getting an interview with as a management consultant. Yeah, and there was a chance, I think 1 out of 10 that I would get this job, because it was kind of the junior position. So you invite 10 people and you're going through a hardcore 1 day integration process, and then they decide afterwards if they want you or not. And this is maybe as close I became to my CIA agent process, right? So I flew halfway around the world to Zurich for this job interview, and after 3 weeks of going all through all kind of interviews and waiting, I actually got the job. So I moved to Zurich, and here I am thinking, okay, Monica, maybe I have to now exchange my Lycra and my dirty for like a business suit, you know. And if you know me, like I grew up with always sport clothes, right? That was my dress. So I felt already very uncomfortable in this whole business suit dress and with a laptop back, you know. And I made it through 1 year. And I got the same feeling as I will in the World Bank.
I like how you describe that as well. I made it through 1 year. I think that kind of says it all.
It was exactly like I made the same mistake again, or not the same mistake, but I was in the same situation, the same condition again as I was at the World Bank, right? Mm-hmm. And those are like highly seen jobs, you know. I mean, you know, for the IBM or working for the World Bank, but it was just not me. You know, that is not where I was happy. But instead of quitting this time, I thought maybe my happiness was in Australia, you know, and I made it to transfer back to Australia. Mm-hmm. So after 1 year in Zurich, I moved to Melbourne with IBM and did the same thing again. But Melbourne was not like Brisbane. Mm-hmm. Melbourne is more like London in regards to the weather, for sure.
Yes.
And actually, you know, I don't know if you've ever written in Australia, and I have a very strongly opinion about it, but the writing there, especially in Melbourne, it was not for me.
I hear that it's not, that the drivers can be very unpleasant, is what I hear, right?
Mm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I did stick around for 2 years. Tried to establish myself, tried to live the way. And I mean, there are a lot of good moments, but you know, it's also, I didn't feel, the cycling in Australia was not, I didn't feel right there. And I started writing actually for a magazine, and I tried to establish myself in the community. I'm very much like, I want, would love to have a good group around. I can, you know, and just have a good time on a bike. And yeah, I started actually writing for one of the magazines there for cycling tips. And this is how I became into, you know, I had always my blog, and then I thought, okay, maybe I could, you know, publish it more for a bigger audience. And then one day I had a chance to go to Europe for 6 weeks. Couldn't find anyone to go to Europe with me though. I had just a free time, and I never actually, I should mention it too, I never, except that professional stint, what I've done like years and years ago, I never actually written in Australia, in Europe. I never done Alpes, I never done Mont-Ventoux. I actually had no idea what is this in Europe. And now here I had free time, 6 weeks, and I could go to Europe and ride my bike. But I was always like, Wouldn't it be boring riding by myself through Europe? And wouldn't I feel lonely actually going there by myself? Because I usually, you know, like people around me. And I was saying, Monica, how stupid would that be that I waste basically those 6 weeks where I could do some of this just to maybe, you know, stay in Melbourne. So I did go to Europe and decided I ride through France and then through Italy. And at first, you know, I felt a little bit kind of, you know, awkward riding with my small little backpack and just riding. But I became more and more in tune with the nature, with trying to find a path, with exploring paths. And I must say that was basically yoga, meditation, exploring all in one. I felt all of a sudden like an entire world of like, you know, I don't need anyone to do the things I love doing, you know. I can explore it all by myself. And then, yeah, 6 weeks. I did that 6 weeks. And there was one day I was sitting on top of one of the climbs in Italy, really enjoyed love. You know, I had this feeling of like, this is me, you know, being doing exactly that. I was like, you know what? Why should I go back to Melbourne sitting in this, you know,
cubicle
job maybe I don't enjoy? And this is what I love doing. This is how, where I, you know, my heart opens up and I feel like I'm breathing, like, you know. And I was so close to call my dad saying, Dad, you know, I don't think I'm returning to Australia. Just stay here. But I couldn't get it, actually. I couldn't get it together because I felt still this failure from 2 years ago, you know, with this sports degree of not making it. And I was like, okay, you know what, Monica, maybe I should give it a few more months. And that was last year, by the way. That was last year in May. I should give it a few more months before I really quit and maybe do something different. Went back to Australia, did my job, and I became again this kind of, you know, not, I've lost for some reason my, you know, energy for life. I didn't like out, you know, and then the weather was kind of, you know, I'm very much
the weather's dependent. A big factor, I have to say.
So all the things came together. And then in December, I said, you know what, Monica, I'm now 32 years old. There I was 31, you know. If I don't do it now, I will never do it. If I want to change something in my life, I have to do it now. And I realized also that maybe it's, I'm trying always to find this perfect job somewhere else out there. Maybe there is no perfect job. Maybe I have to create it, you know.
Yes. I can tell you definitively that there isn't a perfect job. I've tried that. There is no one thing that gives you everything.
Yeah, but maybe something for where you would be satisfied, right?
Yeah. I think there are different different jobs and different things for different moments.
Yes.
And you have to find the right thing for the right moment. But then you can outgrow it as well.
Yeah.
But I've been there. I can totally understand.
Yeah, so in December, I decided, you know what, Monica? I just quit my job without having anything lined up. And it's very... for someone like me, who I like to have things planned, I like to know exactly what is ahead. I don't like too much of uncertainty, you know. It was a very, very weird feeling of just quitting a job and then saying, okay, let's see what comes next, you know. And here I am, you know, in December, said, okay, cool, Monica, now I'm unemployed. Sounds great. That gives me the freedom, though, of doing whatever I want to do and living whatever I want to live. So I looked at the map actually and said, okay, where do I want to live now? Because I can live now anywhere. Well, in reasons, but I decided it has to be the European Union because I'm German and I'm sick of trying to get visas and stuff.
Yeah.
And since I'm unemployed, it might not.
No, I know what it's like as a Canadian living in Europe and having lived in different countries. I understand it completely.
I wanted to move to, because I'm very much into warm weather, right? So a lot of it's cut out. And it has to be an interesting terrain, so something with mountains. And it has to be a cycling-friendly community. So here I am looking at Europe and thought, okay, Italy, Tuscany is the place. And then I looked at the weather in January and I was like, okay, what maybe not. Yeah. So, and then I thought, oh, maybe, okay, then I guess it has to be southern Spain, Malaga. And I had a friend who told me a little bit already about Malaga and about this tiny town east of Malaga, 90 kilometers east of Malaga called Motril. He said, you know, if you want to really learn, like if you want to experience Spain, go there. So here I am. You know, booked a one-way ticket to Malaga, booked a rental car, mm-hmm. one hotel stay, mm-hmm. and took only half of my bags with me because the other bags, I went via Turkish Airlines and they wanted to charge me 1,000 euros for
right.
a bag. And I was like, hey, I don't think I need it anymore. So I had one, my bike and a few clothes, mm-hmm. mostly Lycra with me. And I flew to Malaga and I'd never been there, didn't speak any Spanish and did not know anyone and just, you know, landed and said, wow, this is now the start of a new cool. life. Let's see cool. what's going to happen.
Cool.
And yeah, it was, you know, and I had not really even a plan. I knew I wanted to do something with adventure cycling, but I knew also I don't want to just ride my bike. I need some sort of intellectual stimulation. Mm-hmm. I want to have some sort of, you know, impact of mm-hmm. other mm-hmm. people's life. I don't want to just ride my bike. And yeah, I tried a few things out, being maybe working as a distributor for a cycling clothing company mm-hmm. or being a bike tour guide. But they were all things. So I've tried a few things out, but I always realized this might not be it, but this might not be it. But all the things which I've tried out and which I realized there might not be it actually showed me the way which I wanted to go. Mm-hmm. You know, they helped me to guide me in, sure. in which direction I want to go. I lived in this tiny little town, Motril, had barely any tourists, and I found also a cycling group. They started every day, 9 o'clock from the church, and here I am, rocked up, German rocked up, no Spanish. I thought mangiare is Spanish, it's Italian, mm-hmm. And they did not speak any English, mm-hmm. Any English. First 2 months were kind of awkward silence. No one talked to me, but I learned more and more, you know, Spanish. And after 4 months, I could have a normal, like not normal, but basic conversations with them. And I became, part of their community, which was amazing. But I also knew I had to move on and had to do something now. And during that time, I thought, you know, my thing is to hold those events, cycling challenges, you know, adventuring,
yes.
you know, and inspiring others with it. So I was like, you know what, I have to do at first those adventures to talk about it. So one of the adventures, I went from Madrid to Motril. So those were 600 kilometers and there were no cycling paths and just, and I wrote about it. Then I did, how we met, actually, the Otro Triple Crown.
Yes. That, and congratulations on that, by the way. That's quite a significant achievement.
Thank you. I'm looking now for targeted races and events, which, you know, exactly that's what I was looking for all the years. And then I'm basically writing about it and taking videos now about it and inspiring others and especially women mm-hmm. To get outside and explore mm-hmm. the world, challenge themselves.
And how have you been able to generate an income or keep your living expenses paid? How do you do that?
Currently, I'm, for example, a guest blogger for other blogs. I'm not making the same amount like in the World Bank.
No. But you don't. You don't necessarily need to. But
But I mean, I'm still, you know, it is. I'm giving myself until June next year, okay. so 1.5 years to really establish myself. Currently, I'm still like half on my savings and half of what I'm doing on side jobs and. I want to build up travel blogs. I want to do storybooks.
I think it's you're doing this at a time where there's so many possibilities with things that you can do, whether it's videos on YouTube or blogs or there are all sorts of ways to generate income that didn't exist even 5 years ago, 10 years ago, which is awesome. Yeah. So I think you're coming into this at the right time.
No, and it's exciting. I must say I've never worked so much in my life. And I don't want to call it work though, because I love it. There are times I'm lying in bed, you know, I'm trying to sleep at 11 p.m. and then it's 12 p.m. and I have a notebook next to me because so many ideas come into mind. Oh, I have to do this. Five minutes later, light is switched on and I'm writing more down. But this is, I feel alive. I feel like I'm really can contribute something to now, you know, to society, get the motivation and inspiration of other people. And that is really, and really it's so much more life enriching than I've experienced my previous
interviews. Yeah, that's awesome. And I can tell you, and we were talking a little bit about this before we started to speak, but I think there are a lot of people who, you know, they aren't satisfied with their chosen path or their job or their you know, whatever they're trying to do. And there are different ways to address that, but I think what you've demonstrated is that there isn't you don't have to accept it, right? That you can do all kinds of things.
Yeah. What I definitely realize is by making myself, let's call it, vulnerable being out there, you know, and being, you know, going my own path, actually more opportunities arise than I've ever thought of beforehand. Because all of a sudden people realize when you're telling people, you know, what you're doing, you know, by making actually this kind of very strong cut, you become believable that you actually really want to do that, what you want to do. Then this kind of, yeah, I'm doing this as my hobby, or, you know, I'm doing this on my side. No, this is my job. You know, this is what I'm standing for. This is my mission.
Mm. And it comes from a place of, you know, authenticity that doesn't, yeah, you know, doesn't always come through with a lot of people, right? So that's awesome. What have you learned, or how do you make decisions going from, I suppose, one transition to the next in your life? Is there something that you've learned or something that you've taken away from all of the different things that you've tried and you know, any rules that you sort of picked up along the way?
Yeah. The one thing is, life is actually not black and white, mm-hmm. I realized. Mm. Just because I'm having now no job or something, that does not mean the life is ending, you know. Especially nowadays, there's so many opportunities out there that if you're really just working hard and looking for it, you will find it. Mm. Things don't make me feel more like, I'm now prepared for just changing for a change. You know, if something doesn't work, okay, I'm going to the next one. Yeah. And also life is very flowing. So nowadays, I feel like, you know, maybe I do something now, but in 10 years, you know, mm-hmm. I don't know what I'm doing then. Sure. So things are changing constantly, and just picking up on the opportunities and really listening to, what the when opportunities knock at the door.
That's great advice. That's really, really cool. Really cool stuff. So you said you're someone who likes certainty, but you've done all of these things. So you would, if somebody looked at your kind of path on paper, they might say, oh, this is somebody who's very risk, you know, likes risk and likes uncertainty and likes to, all this exploration and adventure. The way you just talked about it suggests that, you actually, you plan and you strategize and, you know, all of that kind of stuff. How would you characterize your approach to, uncertainty?
Maybe from the outside, it looks very much like, sometimes it might look like that I don't have a plan, mm-hmm. but I have certain rules I'm following, mm-hmm. and those are inherent in rules, right? What can I do, what can't I do, what is risky in a way. It's simple things, for example, in regards, for example, to money, you know, mm-hmm. I try to keep right now all my costs as low as possible, mm-hmm. so I would never enter any kind of agreement which puts me, like, for example, telephone bills or so. Mm. Small things for next 2 years. I wouldn't do things right. Like this. In regards to opportunities, for example, I'm quite open. So through email, I knock on a lot of doors. Mm. So I feel like, especially now, I have to be very open to and flexible of what's coming. Mm. I feel like the same like with startups, right? Sometimes you can't really choose. Mm. You just have to take whatever's out there. Mm. It has changed now a little bit. Now I can start choosing what I want to do. Mm-hmm. Let's say this, what I've learned is from in the past, I was always scared of not having a job and not knowing what's ahead. But now realizing that it will change, that the world has changed in that sense. And I'm very much more, relaxed about it. Mm-hmm. It's ahead. And I always say my dad, I really have a very, very good relationship with my dad, but he has seen me now for 32 years. And one day he came up to me and said, "Monica, I know this is, you most likely will not be able to answer my question, but do you know where you will be living in half a year?" And I was like, "Dad, there's no way." Mm-hmm. So my family doesn't even know where I live in regards to the address, because it changes mm-hmm. quite a lot. Mm-hmm. And I used to always think, oh, maybe I'm running away from something, because people ask me, like, "Monica, you're moving so much around. Mm-hmm. What are you running away from?" Mm-hmm. And I realized, actually, I'm not running away. No, I'm having a huge urge and curiosity for seeing new things, for exploring mm-hmm. new things. So I realized, when you're doing things like this, I feel like you're also getting to know yourself a lot better. You know exactly who you are, you know, and I'm not going with the mainstream. So I feel like accepting who I am is now way stronger, and I feel more confident of my decisions.
That's fabulous. That's really cool, and also counterintuitive, countercultural, all of those things. And I've spoken to a few people with a similar mindset, but there aren't that very many. Do you think that at some point you're going to want to, I don't know, stay in the same place in 10 years? Do you think that's a possibility? Are you can you answer that question even?
In 10 years ago, the same question was asked me, and I said, "Oh yeah, yeah. In 10 years, I know where I'm going." And so I don't know. You know, I think it depends on the circumstances. Mm-hmm. Let's say I'm getting married. Yeah, mm-hmm. then maybe. Mm-hmm. You know, I think it will not so much depend on me, but on the circumstances around. But currently, I don't know.
Cool.
I will maybe find at some point. You know what? Actually, the dream. Not a dream, because my goal would be having like one winter base, which Girona looks very much good for that.
Yep.
And then the summer of traveling, so
that I
get both worlds.
That sounds like a great thing to aspire to. Absolutely. that's awesome. What are your, you talked a little bit about money. What are your, I guess, is that your views on what are your views on money? You don't sound like somebody who wants to accumulate it as much as possible, but I'm just curious about how you, because there's some people that, I want to make as much money as possible, but then have no idea what to do with it, and there are those that are, you know, that don't care at all. I mean, I'm just wondering what your views are on it.
I feel like money is just a tool of making your life happy, right? Or getting you things which make your life more fulfilling. Mm-hmm. And I feel like, I'm not a person I want to get rich or not rich. I don't care. As long as, you know, for me, the money should come naturally, you know, when you are doing something what you love doing and it brings a lot of money. Okay, sure. taking it.
Yeah,
you know?
sure.
But that is definitely not the driving factor. I feel like there is a minimum requirement which should give me like a satisfying life. Yeah. But what comes afterwards, that should more come because the lifestyle I'm living, not because I'm trying to achieve it.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, very cool. I think there is a, I forget the number, but there's a number after which if you earn money, that the more you earn doesn't make any difference to your happiness.
Yeah.
So absolutely. Do you have any medium term goals, like race goals or adventure goals or things you love to do? What's on the bucket list?
I'm glad you asked.
Uh-huh. Okay.
next year, actually, my biggest goal, my biggest project, and I'm yet, I'm telling you first, is actually riding the Vuelta a España. So 3,300 kilometers, 21 days. And I want to do that 3 days before the professionals, before the pros. The reason why I want to do is, first is I want to, riding the Vuelta is a huge challenge. It's, and I think as a, you know, there's, if we talked about it briefly beforehand, women and men are still not, there's a huge gap. Cycling, you know, and especially in regards to grand tours. And I just want to show, you know, a woman can do it too. And I will be inviting actually female cyclists along to, for this tour. And yeah, inspire others to, yeah, again, to go outside, to explore, to challenge themselves, and especially women, that you can do it. There's no reason why.
That sounds awesome. That sounds awesome. Yeah.
That would be the biggest challenge.
Yeah, well, I was listening to, when I was preparing for the Haute Route, I was listening to, or was one video, I think it was with Emma Pooley, who, as you know, is a pro and has ridden the Haute Route for many years. But one of the things she was saying is that actually in the women's professional circuit, there is no race, like actual professional race that... that has the same level of climbing and mountains as the Haute Route, which is just an amateur race, astounding. And then they reduce la course, which is like the women's Tour de France equivalent, quite by a substantial amount this year. So it's there seems to be a discrepancy which should be addressed, you know, quite frankly.
I hope I'm trying to get as much media attention as possible by doing this. Really to maybe, you know, start a little bit like the ball rolling. That would be my goal to show, you know, everyone can do it. Everyone.
And social media attention, you should definitely get all over that. Do some Facebook lives from your bike. You should... all that good stuff so people can follow along. You might find that at first that people start to, and that's, I think it's a perfect idea because I think it's a perfect distance because, you know, 3 weeks, then you start and people at first are just kind of like, oh, you know, I've heard about this. But then as it goes on, more and more people will, you know, tune in. So hopefully,
it eventuates. Currently I'm working on business development in that sense. Like I'm looking out for collaboration partners for this because this is a big undertaking. The more collaborators and the more partners, the better.
Very cool. Have you thought about like crowdfunding and this sort of thing? People can contribute to your cause or something?
Yeah, that would be actually... Thank you.
Yeah, okay. I'll let people know, but no, this is what an awesome idea. You have to keep me appraised of how it's going. I'll do what I can to share, because that's awesome. Okay, cool.
Thank you.
Anything else? I mean, that's already a big enough, short, medium term goal, but, anything else that you sort of thought, this would be awesome. Like, big goal.
One of them is I want to do an adventure cycling trip again. So something like what I love doing is just having a small little backpack, really super small, where there's basically two tubes and a short and a t-shirt. That is what I brought with me. I didn't even have any other shoes. And then just ride across a country or half of a country. I love just having a goal and then really nothing else but myself and trying to reach that goal. And then being creative along the way, you know, when you don't have shoes. So will you buy some, for example, from Walmart or so for €2? Or, you know, will you just ride everywhere? So there's a certain kind of, you always have to think of, like, it makes, when you only have to, when you're trying to how to deal with only minimum amount, it really makes you feel more, I feel like, more alive, more creative, because you have to try to figure out how to solve the problems. And the small problems, but, you know, they're fun. It's fun. So that's what I want to do. Then of course stage races like the Haute Route. I'm thinking of doing the other ones. There are new ones added. And then, you know, there are so many other things which I might not even not know about.
Have you heard of the transcontinental race?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, that sounds like a challenging one.
Yeah, but you know, I was thinking about those ultra endurance races. And my problem with those races is the sleep deprivation.
I always thought about that as well, because I don't want to be riding, you know, sleep deprived at 4 in the morning, all kinds of things could, yeah. could go wrong, right?
Yeah. And that yeah. have
and
been
have.
So.
Yeah. 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 There was a death in the, there was a death this year, wasn't there? Or last year?
In all three, in every yeah. single major yeah. race, there was a yeah. death, unfortunately.
Yeah.
And I feel like with those races, it's not so much about cycling anymore. No question. I mean, you know, yeah. it's a huge, huge challenge, yeah. but it's also about like, how much can you put yourself, your body through sleep, like a little sleep.
Yeah.
And I need my 8 hours, so I would be very poor performer.
Yeah.
So, that's why I
agree. I that's for me. So I have a friend in, who's done the transcontinental race a few times. He just talks about sleep. He just says, well, as soon as I feel a little bit sleepy, I go and have a 20-30 minute nap at the side of the road, kind of a thing. I've not tried it. I know, but I'm not sure it's for it's not something for everyone. Put it that way. But it's an amazing achievement. Clearly.
Exactly. I would say a huge respect to those who are doing it. I mean, that is really, chapeau.
yeah, absolutely. Very cool. Okay, we've been, we've covered a lot of ground, Monica. So I think we want to get close to wrapping, but I feel like I keep talking to you. So we maybe should have you come back at some point. But was there anything that you wanted to cover that we didn't get a chance to?
I think we pretty much covered
a
good part of my life now.
That's awesome. I know it's quite, I'm sure people find it very inspiring. And well, I guess maybe one final thing is like, if there are people who are listening to this and they want to make a change, they want to do something, and maybe it's not the kind of things that you did, but they want to, they've got something in the back of their mind, they've always, I would really like to try to do whatever. What would you say? How would you advise somebody like that?
What I'm always telling myself when I'm trying to figure out if I should do something or not, and I'm always telling Monica, if you were 90 years old, you know, and I'm lying on my deathbed, you know, and looking back at my life, is that decision, would that be something I would regret not doing or doing? Because I feel like sometimes it's the decisions we are making are actually in the, you know, we maybe blow it up more than it actually is, because it's, you know, it's right there in the present. But maybe it's actually a smaller one when we are looking at a grand scheme. It's also really about like, I feel like, you know, as long as you're following your heart and as long as you are true to yourself and real, being real, what you just you, not everyone, anyone else, but you want to do, then you should do it.
That's awesome. Awesome advice. Yeah. Brilliant. So before we go, if people want to, you know, follow you on social media, your adventures, all of that good stuff. I know you do YouTube videos and you're on Instagram, and I'm not sure if you're on Facebook, but if you just let my listeners know where they could find you, that'd be great.
Like right now?
Yes, please. On YouTube, it's
I go basically, my brand name, okay, as I call it, is Rad Monica. Rad, R-A-D, like Rad, which means actually bike in German. So all Instagram, Facebook, YouTube, my blog itself, Strava, everything is under that name, Rad Monica.
Rad Monica. Okay.
Monica, Monica with a K too. It's also German for Rad Monica with a K.
Yeah, very important. I'll put that all in the show notes for this episode and link those all in so people can check out what you're up to. That'd be awesome.
Awesome.
This was great. Yeah, I really I really enjoyed this. So thank you very much
for having me at your podcast, Ben. That has been really great.
Pleasure. No, this is great. I'll make sure that my listeners are aware of how to find you, and certainly post I'll post away when the show goes live. But thank you so much.
Yeah, and if there are any other further questions also from the listeners in regards to, you know, approaching life, and if there's something I can do, I really don't hesitate to reach out.
That's awesome. Yeah.
And Ben?
Yeah.
Of course, if you ever need some sunny days during the winter, come to Girona and visit.
That's I might take you up on that because winter is about to set upon us here in the UK, and I haven't confirmed, but I'm thinking about doing the Haute Route Pyrenees next year, and I'm yeah, I have to you know just and also just get some sunshine, which is
Awesome.
I would recommend cycling in the UK. I think it's great, but I think it's better in the summer. In the spring and the summer. So when you do, when you get a moment, do check out, if you get a bit of time, do check out the UK, but maybe not this time of year. Okay.
Will do.
Thanks, Monica. All the
Awesome.
best.
Thank you.
All right. I hope you guys enjoyed that. Now, since recording this, Monica has moved forward with her 2018 project, which is taking on the entire 3,300-kilometer route of the Vuelta a España. You can check that out at thevueltaride.com. So that's the Vuelta, V-U-E-L-T-A, ride.com, to find out more ways you can support the project, updates, and all of that great stuff. And be sure to check out Monica's website, radmonica.com. That's Monica with a K. So you can subscribe and check out her YouTube videos and blog. And there's loads of great stuff. Of course, all of that is in the show notes as always. And I know I say this very frequently, but if you like this episode and if you like the show, please share it. And what really helps us out is if you leave a rating or a review on iTunes. If you'd like to know how you can subscribe to All Things Risk, allthingsrisk.co.uk is the best place to do that. Any feedback, send it my way. allthingsrisk@gmail.com is also the best place for that. We'll be back with our next episode next week. Until then, and as always, don't forget, risk is life.